for me there. In this whole long time since you left, I've lived with a feeling of having been thrown into absolute darkness. Slowly but surely, though, I am getting closer to the core, to that place where the core of things is located. I wanted to let you know that. I'm getting closer to where you are, and I intend to get closer still. I rest my hands on the keyboard and wait for her answer. I don't understand any of this. Kumiko types this and ends our conversation. Goodbye. The screen informs me that the other party has left the circuit. Our conversation is finished. Still, I go on staring at the screen, waiting for something to happen. Maybe Kumiko will change her mind and come back online. Maybe she'll think of something she forgot to say. But she does not come back. I give up after 20 minutes. I save the file, then go to the kitchen for a drink of cold water. I empty my mind for a while, breathing steadily by the refrigerator. A terrible quiet seems to have descended on everything. I feel as if the world is listening for my next thought. But I can't think of anything. Sorry, but I just can't think of anything. I go back to the computer and sit there, carefully rereading our entire exchange on the glowing tube from beginning to end. What I said, what she said, what I said to that, what she said to that. The whole thing is still there on the screen, with graphic intensity. As my eyes follow the rows of characters she has made, I can hear her voice. I can recognize its rise and fall, the subtle tones and pauses. The cursor on the last line keeps up its blinking with all the regularity of a heartbeat, waiting with bated breath for the next word to be sent. But there is no next word. After engraving the entire conversation in my mind, having decided I'd better not print it out, I click on the box to exit communications mode. I direct the program to leave no record in the operations file, and I cut the switch. The computer beeps, and the monitor goes dead white. The monotonous mechanical drone is swallowed up in the silence of the room, like a vivid dream ripped out by the hand of nothingness. I don't know how much time has gone by since then, but when I realize where I am, I find myself staring at my hands lying on the table. They bear the marks of having had eyes sharply focused on them for a long time. Going bad is something that happens over a longer period of time. How long a period of time is that? 23. Counting sheep. The thing in the center of the circle. A few days after Ushikawa's first visit, I asked Cinnamon to bring me a newspaper whenever he came to the residence. It was time for me to start getting in touch with the reality of the outside world. Try as you might to avoid it, when it was time, they came for you. Cinnamon nodded, and every day after that he would arrive with 3 newspapers. I would look through the papers after breakfast. I'd not bothered with newspapers for such a long time that they now struck me as strange, cold, and empty. The stimulating smell of the ink gave me a headache, and the intensely black little gangs of type seemed to stab at my eyes. The layout and the headlines, type style, and the tone of the writing seemed unreal to me. I often had to put the paper down and close my eyes and release a sigh. It couldn't have been like this in the old days. Reading a newspaper must have been a far more ordinary experience than this. What had changed so much about them, or rather, what had changed so much about me? After I'd been reading the papers for a while, I was able to achieve a clear understanding of one fact concerning Noboru Wataya, that he was constructing an ever more solid position for himself in society. At the same time that he was conducting an ambitious program of political activity as one of the up-and-coming new members of the House of Representatives, he was also making constant public pronouncements as a magazine columnist and a commentator on TV. I would see his name everywhere. For some reason I could not fathom, people were listening to his opinions, and with ever-increasing enthusiasm. He was a newcomer to the political stage, but he was already being celebrated as one of the young politicians from whom great things could be expected. He was named the country's most popular politician in a poll conducted by a women's magazine. He was hailed as an activist intellectual, a new type of intelligent politician that had not been seen before. When I had read as much as I could stand about current events and Noboru Wataya's prominent place in them, I turned to my growing collection of books on Manchukuo. Cinnamon had been bringing me everything he could find on the subject. Even here, though, I could not escape the shadow of Noboru Wataya. That day it emerged from the pages of a book on logistical problems. Published in 1978, the library copy had been borrowed only once before, when the book was new and returned almost immediately. Perhaps only acquaintances of Lieutenant Mamiya were interested in logistical problems in Manchukuo. As early as 1920, according to the author, Japan's Imperial Army was looking into the possibility of amassing a huge stock of winter survival gear in anticipation of all-out war with the Soviets. Equipping the army to fight in bitter cold was viewed as an urgent matter because they lacked the experience of having fought a real battle anywhere with such extreme winter cold as Siberia. If a border dispute led to a sudden declaration of war against the Soviet Union, which was by no means out of the question in those days, the army would be unprepared for a winter campaign. For this reason, a research team was established within the General Staff Office to prepare to fight a hypothetical war with the Soviet Union, the logistics section being charged with investigating the procurement of special winter clothing. In order to grasp what real cold was like, they went to the far northern island of Sakhalin, long a point of dispute with Tsarist Russia, and then the Soviet Union, and used an actual fighting unit to test insulated boots and coats and underwear. They ran thorough tests on equipment then in use by the Soviet Army, and on the kind of clothing that Napoleon's army had used in its Russian campaign, reaching the conclusion that it would be impossible for the Japanese army to survive a winter in Siberia with its present equipment. They estimated that some two-thirds of the foot soldiers on the front lines would be put out of commission by frostbite. The army's current survival gear had been manufactured with the gentler northern China winters in mind, and in addition, there were too few kits to go around. The research team calculated the number of sheep necessary to manufacture sufficient effective winter clothing to outfit 10 divisions, the joke making the rounds of the team then being that they were too busy counting sheep to sleep, and they submitted this in their report along with estimates of the mechanical equipment that would be needed to process the wool. The number of sheep on the Japanese home islands was insufficient for fighting an extended war in the northern territories against the Soviet army in the event of economic sanctions or blockade against Japan, and thus it was imperative that Japan secure both a stable supply of wool and of rabbit and other pelts in the Manchuria-Mongolia region and the mechanical equipment for processing it, said the report. The man dispatched to make on-the-spot observations in Manchukuo in 1932, immediately after the founding of the puppet regime there, was a young technocrat, newly graduated from the military staff college, with a degree in logistics. His name was Yoshitaka Wataya. Yoshitaka Wataya? This could only have been Noboru's uncle. There weren't that many Watayas in the world, and the name Yoshitaka was the clincher. His mission was to calculate the time that would be needed before stable supplies of wool could be secured in Manchukuo. Yoshitaka Wataya seized upon this problem of cold weather clothing as a model case for modern logistics and carried out an exhaustive numerical analysis. When he was in Mukden, Yoshitaka Wataya sought an introduction to and spent the entire night drinking and talking with Lieutenant General Kanji Ishiwara. Kanji Ishiwara. Another name I knew well. Noboru Wataya's uncle had been in touch with Kanji Ishiwara, the ringleader the year before of the staged Chinese attack on Japanese troops, known as the Manchurian Incident, the event that had enabled Japan to turn Manchuria into Manchukuo, and that later would prove to have been the first aggressive act in 15 years of war. Ishiwara had toured the continent and become convinced not only that all-out war with the Soviet Union was inevitable, but that the key to winning that war lay in strengthening Japan's logistical position by rapidly industrializing the new empire of Manchukuo and establishing a self-sufficient economy. He presented his case to Yoshitaka Wataya with eloquence and passion. He argued, too, for the importance of bringing farmers from Japan to systematize Manchukuo's farming and cattle industries and to increase their efficiency. Ishiwara was of the opinion that Japan should not turn Manchukuo into another undisguised Japanese colony, such as Korea or Taiwan, and should instead make Manchukuo a new model Asian nation. In his recognition that Manchukuo would serve as a logistical base for war against the Soviet Union and even against the United States and England, Ishiwara was, however, admirably realistic. He believed that Japan was now the only Asian nation capable of fighting the coming war against the West, or, as he called it, the final war, and that the other countries had the duty to cooperate with Japan to secure their own liberation from the West. No other officer in the Imperial Army at that time had Ishiwara's profound interest in logistics combined with his great erudition. Most other Japanese officers dismissed logistics as an effeminate discipline, believing instead that the proper way for His Majesty's warriors was to fight with bold self-abandonment no matter how ill-equipped they might be. That true martial glory lay in conquering a mighty foe when outnumbered and poorly armed. Strike the enemy and advance, too swiftly for supplies to keep up. That was the path of honor. To Yoshitaka Wataya, the complete technocrat, this was utter nonsense. Starting a long-term war without logistical backing was tantamount to suicide, in his view. The Soviets had vastly expanded and modernized their military capability through Stalin's 5-year plan of intensive economic development. The 5 bloody years of the First World War had destroyed the old world's values, and mechanized war had revolutionized European thinking with regard to strategy and logistics. Having been stationed for 2 years in Berlin, Yoshitaka Wataya felt the truth of this in every bone of his body. But the mentality of the greater part of Japan's military men had not outgrown the intoxication of their victory in the Russo-Japanese War nearly 30 years before. Yoshitaka Wataya went home to Japan a devoted admirer of Ishiwara's arguments, his worldview, and the charismatic personality of the man himself, and their close relationship lasted many years. He often went to visit Ishiwara, even after the distinguished officer had been brought back from Manchuria, to take command of the isolated fortress in Maizuru. Yoshitaka Wataya's precise and meticulous report on sheep farming and wool processing in Manchukuo was submitted to headquarters shortly after he returned to Japan, and it received high praise. With Japan's painful defeat in the 1939 Battle of Nomonhan, however, and the strengthening of U.S. and British economic sanctions, the military began to shift its attention southward, and the activities of the research team waging hypothetical war against the Soviet Union were allowed to peter out. Of course, one factor behind the decision to finish off the Battle of Nomonhan quickly in early autumn and not allow it to develop into a full-scale war was the research team's conclusive report that we are unable to wage a winter campaign against the Soviet Army given our current state of preparedness. As soon as the autumn winds began to blow, Imperial headquarters, in a move unusual for the normally face-obsessed Japanese army, washed its hands of the fighting and, through diplomatic negotiations, ceded the barren Hulunbuir steppe to Outer Mongolian and Soviet troops. In a footnote, the author pointed out that Yoshitaka Wataya had been banned from holding public office by MacArthur's occupation after the war, and for a time had lived in seclusion in his native Niigata. But he had been persuaded by the Conservative Party to run for office after the ban was lifted, and served 2 terms in the upper house before transferring to the lower house. A calligraphic scroll of Kanji Ishiwara's hung on the wall of his office. I had no idea what kind of Diet member Noboru Wataya's uncle had been, or what he had accomplished as a politician. He did serve as a cabinet minister once, and he seems to have been highly influential with the people of his district, but he never became a leader in national politics. Now his political constituency had been inherited by his nephew, Noboru Wataya. I put the book away, and, folding my arms behind my head, stared out the window in the vague direction of the front gate. Soon the gate would open inwards and the Mercedes-Benz would appear, with Cinnamon at the wheel. He would be bringing another client. These clients and I were linked by the mark on my cheek. Cinnamon's grandfather, Nutmeg's father, and I were also linked by the mark on my cheek. Cinnamon's grandfather and Lieutenant Mamiya were linked by the city of Xinjing. Lieutenant Mamiya and the clairvoyant Mr. Honda were linked by their special duties on the Manchurian-Mongolian border, and Kumiko and I had been introduced to Mr. Honda by Noboru Wataya's family. Lieutenant Mamiya and I were linked by our experiences in our respective wells, his in Mongolia, mine on the property where I was now sitting. Also on this property had once lived an army officer who had commanded troops in China. All of these were linked as in a circle, at the center of which stood pre-war Manchuria, continental East Asia, and the short war of 1939 in Nomonhan. But why Kumiko and I should have been drawn into this historical chain of cause and effect, I could not comprehend. All of these events had occurred long before Kumiko and I were born. I sat at Cinnamon's desk and placed my hands on the keyboard. The feel of my fingers on the keys was still fresh from my conversation with Kumiko. That computer conversation had been monitored by Noboru Wataya, I was sure. He was trying to learn something from it. He certainly hadn't arranged for us to make contact that way out of the goodness of his heart. He and his men were almost certainly trying to use the access they had gained to Cinnamon's computer through the communications link to learn the secrets of this place. But I was not worried about that. The depths of this computer were the very depths of Cinnamon himself, and they had no way of knowing how incalculably deep that was. 24. The signal turns red. The long arm reaches out. Cinnamon was not alone when he arrived at 9 o'clock the next morning. Beside him in the passenger seat was his mother, Nutmeg Akasaka. She had not been here for over a month. She had arrived with Cinnamon unannounced that time, too, had breakfast with me, and left after an hour or so of small talk. Cinnamon hung up his jacket, and while listening to a Handel concerto grosso for the third day in a row, he went to the kitchen to make tea and toast for his mother, who had not yet eaten breakfast. He always made perfect toast, like something out of a commercial. Then, while Cinnamon straightened up the kitchen, as usual, Nutmeg and I sat at a small table drinking tea. She ate only one slice of toast with a little butter. Outside, a cold, sleety rain was falling. Nutmeg said little, and I said little, a few remarks about the weather. She seemed to have something she wanted to say, though. That much was clear from the look on her face and the way she spoke. She tore off stamp-sized pieces of toast and transported them one at a time to her mouth. We looked out at the rain now and then, as if it were our long-time mutual friend. When Cinnamon had finished with the kitchen and started his cleaning, Nutmeg led me to the fitting room. This one had been made to look exactly like the fitting room in the Akasaka office. The size and shape were almost identical. The window here also had two layers of curtains and was gloomy even during the day. The curtains were never open more than 10 minutes at a time while Cinnamon was cleaning the room. There was a leather sofa here, a glass vase with flowers on the table, and a tall floor lamp. In the middle of the room stood a large workbench on which lay a pair of scissors, scraps of cloth, a wooden box stuffed with needles and thread, pencils, a design book in which a few design sketches had been drawn, and several professional tools, the names and purposes of which I did not know. A large full-length mirror hung on the wall, and one corner of the room was partitioned off by a screen for changing. The clients who visited the residence were always shown to this room. Why Cinnamon and his mother had felt the need to make an exact reproduction of the original fitting room, I had no idea. Here there was no need for such camouflage. Maybe they and their clients had become so accustomed to the look of the room in the Akasaka office that they were unable to come up with any new ideas for decorating this place. Of course, they could just as well ask, What's wrong with the fitting room? Whatever the reason for having it, I myself was pleased with it. It was the fitting room, not any other room, and I felt a strange sense of security there, surrounded by all kinds of dressmaking tools. It was an unreal setting, but not an unnatural one. Nutmeg bid me sit on the leather sofa and sat down next to me.
So, how are you feeling? She asked.
Not bad, I answered. Nutmeg was wearing a bright green suit. The skirt was short, and the large hexagonal buttons came up to the throat like one of those old Nehru jackets. The shoulders had pads the size of bread rolls. The look reminded me of a science fiction movie I had seen a long time ago, set in the near future. Almost all the women in the movie wore suits like this and lived in a futuristic city. Nutmeg's earrings were large plastic things, the exact color of her suit. They were a unique deep green that seemed to have been made from a combination of several colors and had probably been ordered specially to match the suit. Or perhaps the opposite was true. The suit had been made to match the earrings, like making a niche in the wall the exact shape of a refrigerator. Maybe not a bad way to look at things, I thought. She had arrived wearing sunglasses, in spite of the rain, and their lenses had almost certainly been green. Her stockings were green, too. Today was obviously Green Day. With her usual series of smooth, linked movements, Nutmeg drew a cigarette from her bag, put it in her mouth, and lit it with her cigarette lighter, curling her lip just a little. The lighter at least was not green, but the expensive-looking slim gold one she always used. It did go very well with the green, though. Nutmeg then crossed her green-stockinged legs. Checking her knees, she adjusted her skirt. Then, as if it were an extension of her knees, she looked at my face. "Not bad," I said again. "The same as always." Nutmeg nodded.
"You're not tired? You don't feel as if you need some rest?"
"No, not especially. I think I've become used to the work. It's a lot easier now than it was at first." Nutmeg said nothing to that. The smoke of her cigarette rose straight up like an Indian fakir's magic rope to be sucked in by the ceiling ventilator. As far as I knew, this ventilator was the world's quietest and most powerful. "How are you doing?" I asked.
"Me? Are you tired?"
Nutmeg looked at me.
"Do I look tired?"
She had, in fact, looked tired to me from the moment our eyes first met. When I told her this, she gave a short sigh.
"There was another article about this place in a magazine that came out this morning. Part of the mystery of the Hanging House series. Sounds like the title of a horror movie."
"That's the second one, isn't it?" I said.
"It certainly is," said Nutmeg. "And in fact, another magazine carried a related article not too long ago, but fortunately no one seems to have noticed the connection. So far."
"Did something new come out? About us?" She reached for an ashtray and stubbed out her cigarette. Then she gave her head a little shake. Her green earrings fluttered like butterflies in early spring.
"Not really,"
she said, then paused.
"Who we are, what we're doing here, no one knows yet. I'll leave you a copy so you can read it if you're interested, but what I'd really like to ask you about is something that somebody whispered to me the other day, that you have a brother-in-law who's a famous young politician. Is it true?"
"Unfortunately, it is," I said. "My wife's brother."
"Meaning the brother of the wife who's no longer with you?"
"That's right."
"I wonder if he's caught wind of what you're doing here."
"He knows I come here every day and that I'm doing something. He hired somebody to investigate for him. I think he was worried about what I might be doing, but I don't think he's found out anything yet." Nutmeg thought about my answer for a while. Then she raised her face to mine and asked,
"You don't like this brother-in-law of yours very much, do you?"
"Not very much, no."
"And he doesn't like you?"
"To put it mildly."
"And now he's worried about what you're doing here? Why is that?"
"If it comes out that his brother-in-law is involved in something suspicious, it could turn into a scandal for him. He's the man of the moment, after all. I suppose it's natural that he would worry about such things."
So he couldn't be the one leaking information about this place to the mass media then, could he?
To be quite honest, I don't know what Noboru Wataya has in mind, but common sense tells me he'd have nothing to gain by leaking things to the press. He'd be more likely to want to keep things under wraps. For a long time, Nutmeg went on turning the slim gold lighter in her fingers. It looked like a gold windmill on a day with little wind.
"Why haven't you said anything to us about this brother-in-law of yours?"
Nutmeg asked.
"It isn't just you. I try not to mention him to anybody," I said. "We haven't liked each other from the start, and now we practically hate each other. I wasn't hiding him from you. I just didn't think there was any need to bring up the subject."
Nutmeg sighed.
"You should have told us."
"Maybe I should have," I said.
"I'm sure you can imagine what's involved here. We have clients coming to us from politics and business, powerful people and famous people. Their privacy has to be protected. That's why we've taken such extreme precautions. You know that much."
I nodded.
"Cinnamon has gone to a lot of time and trouble to put together the precise and complicated system we have for maintaining our secrecy. A labyrinth of dummy companies, accounts hidden under layers of camouflage, an anonymous parking space in that hotel in Akasaka, stringent management of the clientele, control of income and expenses, design of this house. His mind gave birth to all of this. Until now, the system has worked almost perfectly in accordance with his calculations. Of course, it takes a lot of money to support such a system, but money is no problem for us. The important thing is that the women who come to us can feel secure that they will be protected absolutely."
"What you're saying is that that security is being undermined."
"Yes, unfortunately."
Nutmeg picked up a box of cigarettes and took one out, but held it for a long time between her fingers without lighting it.
"And to make matters worse, I have this famous politician for a brother-in-law, which only increases the possibility of scandal."
"Exactly,"
said Nutmeg, curling her lip.
"So what is Cinnamon's analysis of the situation?"
"He's not saying anything. Like a big oyster on the bottom of the sea. He's burrowed inside himself and locked the door, and he's doing some serious thinking."
Nutmeg's eyes were fixed on mine. At last, as though recalling that it was there in her hand, she lit her cigarette. Then she said,
"I still think about it a lot. About my husband and the way he was killed. Why did they have to murder him? Why did they have to smear the hotel room with blood and tear out his insides and take them away? I can't think of any reason for doing such a thing. My husband was not the kind of person who had to be killed in such an unusual way. But my husband's death is not the only thing. All these inexplicable events that have occurred in my life so far, the intense passion that welled up inside me for fashion design, and the way it disappeared all of a sudden, the way Cinnamon stopped speaking, the way I became swept up in the strange work we do. It's as though they were all ingeniously programmed from the start for the very purpose of bringing me here, where I am today. It's a thought I can't seem to shake off. I feel as if my every move is being controlled by some kind of long arm that's reaching out from somewhere far away, and that my life has been nothing more than a convenient passageway for all these things moving through it."
The faint sounds of Cinnamon's vacuuming came from the next room. He was performing his tasks in his usual concentrated, systematic manner.
"Haven't you ever felt that way?"
Nutmeg asked me.
"I don't feel that I've been swept up in anything," I said. "I'm here now because it was necessary for me to be here."
"So you could blow the magic flute and find Kumiko?"
"That's right."
"You have something you're searching for,"
she said, slowly recrossing her green stockinged legs.
"And everything has its price."
I remained silent. Then, at last, Nutmeg announced her conclusion.
"We've decided not to bring any clients here for a while. It was Cinnamon's decision. Because of the magazine articles and your brother-in-law's appearance on the scene, the signal has changed from yellow to red. Yesterday, we canceled all remaining appointments, beginning with today's."
How long will a while be?
Until Cinnamon can patch the holes in the system, and we can be sure that any crisis has been completely bypassed. Sorry, but we don't want to take any chances, none at all. Cinnamon will come here every day, as he always has, but there will be no more clients.
By the time Cinnamon and Nutmeg left, the morning rain had cleared. Half a dozen sparrows were washing their feathers in a puddle in the driveway. When Cinnamon's Mercedes disappeared and the automatic gate closed, I sat at the window, looking at the cloudy winter sky beyond the tree branches. Nutmeg's words came to mind. Some kind of long arm that's reaching out from somewhere far away. I imagined the arm reaching down from the dark, low-hanging clouds, like an illustration from a sinister picture book.
25. Triangular Ears, Sleigh Bells.
I spent the rest of the day reading about Manchu Kuo. There was no need for me to hurry back home. Thinking I might be late, I had given Mackerel 2 days' worth of dried cat food when I left in the morning. He might not like it much, but at least he wouldn't starve. This made the thought of dragging myself home that much less appealing. I wanted to lie down and take a nap. I took a blanket and pillow from a cabinet, spread them on the sofa in the fitting room, and turned out the light. Then I lay down, closed my eyes, and began thinking about Mackerel. I wanted to fall asleep thinking about the cat. He was something that had come back to me. He had managed to come back to me from somewhere far away. That had to be a kind of blessing. As I lay there with my eyes closed, I thought about the soft touch of the pads on the underside of the cat's paws, the cold triangular ears, the pink tongue. In my mind, Mackerel had curled up and was sleeping quietly. I felt his warmth with the palm of my hand. I could hear his regular breathing. I was far more on edge than usual, but sleep came to me before too long, a deep sleep, without dreams. I awoke in the middle of the night. I thought I had heard sleigh bells somewhere far away, as in the background of Christmas music. Sleigh bells? I sat up on the sofa and felt for my watch on the coffee table. The luminous hands showed 1:30. I must have slept more soundly than I had expected to. I sat still and listened hard, but the only sound I could hear was the faint, dry thumping of my own heart. Maybe I had imagined the sleigh bells. Maybe I had been dreaming after all. I decided, nevertheless, to check the house. I stepped into my slippers and padded into the kitchen. The sound grew more distinct when I left the room. It really did sound like sleigh bells, and it seemed to be coming from Cinnamon's office. I stood by the door for a while, listening, then gave a knock. Cinnamon might have come back to the residence while I was sleeping, but there was no answer. I opened the door a crack and looked inside. Somewhere around waist height in the darkness I could see a whitish glow and a square shape. It was the glow of the computer screen, and the bell sound was the machine's repeated beeping, a new kind of beep which I had not heard before. The computer was calling out to me. As if drawn towards it, I sat down in front of the glow and read the message on the screen. You have now gained access to the program The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle. Choose a document 1 to 16. Someone had turned the computer on and accessed documents titled The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle. There should have been no one in the residence besides me. Could someone have started it from outside the house? If so, it could only have been Cinnamon. The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle? The light, cheery sound, like sleigh bells, continued to emanate from the computer as if it were Christmas morning. It seemed to be urging me to make a choice. After some hesitation, I picked number 8 for no particular reason. The ringing stopped, and a document opened on the screen like a horizontal scroll painting being spread out before me.
26.
The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle, Number 8, or A Second Clumsy Massacre. The veterinary surgeon woke before 6 a.m. After washing his face in cold water, he made himself breakfast. Daybreak came at an early hour in summer, and most of the animals in the zoo were already awake. The open window let in their cries and the breeze that carried their smells, which told him the weather without his having to look outside. This was part of his routine. He would first listen, then inhale the morning air, and so ready himself for each new day. Today, however, should have been different from the day before. It had to be different. So many voices and smells had been lost. The tigers, the leopards, the wolves, the bears, all had been liquidated by soldiers the previous afternoon. Now, after a night of sleep, those events seemed like part of a sluggish nightmare he had had long ago. But he knew they had really happened. His ears still felt a dull ache from the roar of the soldiers' rifles. That could not be a dream. It was August now, the year was 1945, and he was here in the city of Xinjiang, where the Soviet troops that had burst across the border were pressing closer every hour. This was reality, as real as the sink and toothbrush he saw in front of him. The sound of the elephants trumpeting gave him some sense of relief. Ah, yes, the elephants had survived. Fortunately, the young lieutenant in charge of the platoon had to remove the elephants from the list, thought the vet as he washed his face. Since coming to Manchuria, he had met any number of stiff-necked, fanatical young officers from his homeland, and the experience always left him shaken. Most of them were farmers' sons who had spent their youthful years in the depressed 30s, steeped in the tragedies of poverty, while a megalomaniac nationalism was hammered into their skulls. They would follow without a second thought the orders of a superior, no matter how outlandish. Commanded in the name of the emperor to dig a hole through the earth to Brazil, they would grab a shovel and set to work. Some people called this purity, but the vet had other words for it. An urban doctor's son, educated in the relatively liberal atmosphere of the 20s, the vet could not understand those young officers. Shooting a couple of elephants with small arms should have been far easier than digging through the earth to Brazil, but the lieutenant in charge of the firing squad, though he spoke with a slight country accent, seemed to be a more normal human being than the other young officers the vet had met. Better educated and more reasonable. The vet could sense this from the way the young man spoke and handled himself. In any case, the elephants had not been killed, and the vet told himself he should be grateful. The soldiers, too, must have been glad to be spared the task. The Chinese workers may have regretted the omission. They had missed out on a lot of meat and ivory. The vet boiled water in a kettle, soaked his beard in a hot towel, and shaved. Then he ate breakfast alone, tea, toast, and butter. The food rations in Manchuria were far from sufficient, but compared with those elsewhere, they were generous. This was good news both for him and for the animals. The animals showed resentment at their reduced allowances of feed, but the situation here was far better than in Japanese homeland zoos, where foodstuffs had already run out. No one could predict the future, but for now at least both animals and humans were being spared the pain of extreme hunger. He wondered how his wife and daughter were doing. If all went according to plan, their train should have arrived in Busan by now. His cousin, who worked for the railway company, lived here, and until the vet's wife and daughter were able to board the transport ship that would carry them to Japan, they would stay with the cousin's family. The doctor missed seeing them when he woke up in the morning. He missed hearing their lovely voices as they prepared breakfast. A hollow quiet ruled the house. This was no longer the home he loved, the place where he belonged. And yet at the same time, he could not help feeling a certain strange joy at being left alone in this empty official residence. Now he was able to sense the implacable power of fate in his very bones and flesh. Fate itself was the doctor's own fatal disease. From his youngest days he had had a lucid awareness that I, as an individual, am living under the control of some outside force. This may have been owing to the vivid blue mark on his right cheek. When a child, he had hated this mark, this imprint that only he and no one else had to bear upon his flesh.
He wanted to die whenever the other children taunted him or strangers stared at him. If only he could have cut away that part of his body with a knife. But as he matured, he came to a quiet acceptance of the mark on his face that would never go away. And this may have been a factor that helped form his attitude of resignation in all matters having to do with fate. Most of the time, the power of fate played on like a quiet and monotonous ground bass, coloring only the edges of his life. Seldom was he reminded of its existence, but every once in a while, when the balance would shift, and what controlled the balance he never knew, he could discover no regularity in those shifts, the force would increase, plunging him into a state of near paralytic resignation. At such times he had no choice but to abandon everything and give himself up to the flow. He knew from experience that nothing he could do or think would ever change the situation. Fate would demand its portion, and until it received that portion, it would never go away. He believed this with his whole heart. Not that he was a passive creature. Indeed, he was more decisive than most, and he always saw his decisions through. In his profession, he was outstanding, a vet of exceptional skill, a tireless educator. He may have lacked a certain creative spark, but at school he had always achieved high marks and was chosen to be the leader of the class. In the workplace, too, others acknowledged his superiority, and his juniors always looked up to him. He was certainly no fatalist, as most people use the word, and yet never once in his life had he experienced the unshakable certainty that he and he alone had arrived at a decision. He always had the feeling that fate had forced him to decide things to suit its own convenience. On occasion, after the momentary satisfaction of having decided something of his own free will, he would see that things had been determined beforehand by an external power, cleverly camouflaged as free will, mere bait thrown in his path to lure him into behaving as he was meant to. The only things that he had decided for himself with complete independence were the kind of trivial matters which, on closer inspection, revealed themselves to require no decision-making at all. He felt like a titular head of state who did nothing more than stamp the royal seal on documents at the behest of a regent who wielded all true power in the realm, like the emperor of this puppet empire of Manchukuo. The doctor loved his wife and child. They were the most wonderful thing that had ever happened to him, especially his daughter, for whom his love bordered on obsession. For them, he would have gladly given up his life. Indeed, he had often imagined doing so, and the deaths he had endured for them in his mind seemed the sweetest deaths imaginable. At the same time, however, he would often come home from work and, seeing his wife and daughter there, think to himself, "These people are finally separate human beings, with whom I have no connection." They were something other, something of which he had no true knowledge, something that existed in a place far away from the doctor himself. And whenever he felt this way, the thought would cross his mind that he himself had chosen neither of these people on his own, which did not prevent him from loving them unconditionally, without the slightest reservation. This was, for the doctor, a great paradox, an insoluble contradiction, a gigantic trap that had been set for him in his life. The world he belonged to became far simpler, far easier to understand, though, once he was left alone in his residence at the zoo. All he had to think about was taking care of the animals. His wife and daughter were gone. There was no need to think about them for now. The vet and his fate could be alone together. And it was fate, above all, the gigantic power of fate that held sway over the city of Xinjing in August of 1945. Not the Kwantung Army, not the Soviet Army, not the troops of the Communists or of the Kuomintang. Anyone could see that fate was the ruler here, and that individual will counted for nothing. It was fate that had spared the elephants and buried the tigers and leopards and wolves and bears the day before. What would it bury now, and what would it spare? These were questions that no one could answer. The doctor left his residence to prepare for the morning feeding. He assumed that no one would show up for work anymore, but he found two Chinese boys waiting for him in his office. He did not know them. They were 13 or 14 years old, had dark complexions, and were skinny with roving animal eyes. "They told us to help you," said one boy. The doctor nodded. He asked their names, but they made no reply. Their faces remained blank, as if they had not heard the question. These boys must have been sent by the Chinese people who had worked here until the day before. Those people had probably ended all contact with Japanese now, in anticipation of changes to come, but assumed that children would not be held accountable. The boys had been sent as a sign of goodwill. The workers knew that he could not care for the animals alone. The vet gave each boy 2 biscuits, then put them to work helping him feed the animals. They led a mule-drawn cart from cage to cage, providing each animal with its particular feed and changing its water. Cleaning the cages was out of the question. The best they could manage was a quick hose down to wash away the droppings. The zoo was closed, after all. No one would complain if it stank a little. As it turned out, the absence of the tigers, leopards, bears, and wolves made the job far easier. Caring for big carnivores was a major effort, and dangerous. As bad as the doctor felt when passing their empty cages, he could not suppress a sense of relief to have been spared that job. They started the work at 8 o'clock and finished after 10. The boys then disappeared without a word. The vet felt exhausted from the hard physical labor. He went back to the office and reported to the zoo director that the animals had been fed. Just before noon, the young lieutenant came back to the zoo leading the same 8 soldiers he had brought with him the day before. Fully armed again, they walked with a metallic clinking that could be heard far in advance of their arrival. Again, their shirts were blackened with sweat, and again the cicadas were screaming in the trees. Today, however, they had not come to kill animals. The lieutenant saluted the director and said, "We need to know the current status of the zoo's usable carts and draft animals." The director informed him that they had exactly 1 mule and 1 wagon. "We contributed our only truck and 2 horses 2 weeks ago," he noted. The lieutenant nodded and announced that he was commandeering the mule and wagon as per orders of Kwantung Army Headquarters. "Wait just a minute," the vet interjected. "We need those to feed the animals twice a day. All our local people have disappeared. Without that mule and wagon, our animals will starve to death. Even with them, we can barely keep up." "We're all just barely keeping up, sir," said the lieutenant, whose eyes were red and whose face was covered with stubble. "Our first priority is to defend the city. You can always let the animals out of their cages if need be. We've taken care of the dangerous meat-eaters. The others pose no security risk. These are military orders, sir. You'll just have to manage." Cutting the discussion short, the lieutenant ordered his men to take the mule and wagon. When they were gone, the vet and the director looked at each other. The director sipped his tea, shook his head, and said nothing. 4 hours later, the soldiers were back with the mule and wagon, a filthy canvas tarpaulin covering the mounded contents of the wagon. The mule was panting, its hide foaming with the afternoon heat and the weight of the load. The 8 soldiers marched 4 Chinese men ahead of them at bayonet point, young men, perhaps 20 years old, wearing baseball uniforms and with their hands tied behind their backs. The blue and black marks on their faces made it obvious that they had been severely beaten. The right eye of one man was swollen almost shut, and the bleeding lips of another had stained his baseball shirt bright red. The shirt fronts had nothing written on them, but there were small rectangles where the name patches had been torn off. The numbers on their backs were 1, 4, 7, and 9. The vet could not begin to imagine why, at such a time of crisis, 4 young Chinese men would be wearing baseball uniforms, or why they had been so badly beaten and dragged here by Japanese troops. The scene looked like something not of this world, a painting by a mental patient. The lieutenant asked the zoo director if he had any picks and shovels he could let them use. The young officer looked even more pale and haggard than he had before. The vet led him and his men to a tool shed behind the office. The lieutenant chose 2 picks and 2 shovels for his men. Then he asked the vet to come with him, and leaving his men there, walked into a thicket beyond the road. The vet followed. Wherever the lieutenant walked, huge grasshoppers scattered. The smell of summer grass hung in the air, mixed in with the deafening screams of cicadas. The sharp trumpeting of elephants now and then seemed to sound a distant warning. The lieutenant walked on among the trees without speaking until he found a kind of opening in the woods. The area had been earmarked for construction of a plaza for small animals that children could play with. The plan had been postponed indefinitely, however, when the worsening military situation caused a shortage of construction materials. The trees had been cleared away to make a circle of bare ground, and the sun illuminated this one part of the woods like stage lighting. The lieutenant stood in the center of the circle and scanned the area. Then he dug at the ground with the heel of his boot.
"We're going to bivouac here for a while,"
he said, kneeling down and scooping up a handful of dirt. The vet nodded in response. He had no idea why they had to bivouac in a zoo, but he decided not to ask. Here in Xinjiang, experience had taught him never to question military men. Questions did nothing but make them angry, and in any case, they never gave you a straight answer.
"First we dig a big hole here,"
the lieutenant said as if speaking to himself. He stood up and took a pack of cigarettes from his shirt pocket. Putting a cigarette between his lips, he offered one to the doctor, then lit both with a match. The two concentrated on their smoking to fill the silence. Again the lieutenant began digging at the ground with his boot. He drew a kind of diagram in the earth, then rubbed it out. Finally, he asked the vet,
"Where are you born?"
"In Kanagawa,"
the doctor said, "in a town called Ofuna, near the sea." The lieutenant nodded.
"And where were you born?"
the vet asked. Instead of answering, the lieutenant narrowed his eyes and watched the smoke rising from between his fingers. No, it never pays to ask a military man questions, the vet told himself again. They like to ask questions, but they'll never give you an answer. They wouldn't give you the time of day. Literally.
"There's a movie studio there," said the lieutenant. It took the doctor a few seconds to realize the lieutenant was talking about Ofuna.
"That's right, a big studio. I've never been inside, though."
The lieutenant dropped what was left of his cigarette on the ground and crushed it out.
"I hope you make it back there," he said. "Of course, there's an ocean to cross between here and Japan. We'll probably all die over here."
He kept his eyes on the ground as he spoke.
"Tell me, doctor, are you afraid of death?"
"I guess it depends on how you die," said the vet after a moment's thought.
The lieutenant raised his eyes and looked at the vet as if his curiosity had been aroused. He had apparently been expecting another answer.
"You're right," he said. "It does depend on how you die."
The two remained silent for a time. The lieutenant looked as if he might fall asleep right there, standing up. He was obviously exhausted. A large grasshopper flew over them like a bird and disappeared into a distant clump of grass with a noisy beating of wings. The lieutenant looked at his watch.
"Time to get started,"
he said to no one in particular. Then he spoke to the vet.
"I'd like you to stay around for a while. I might have to ask you to do me a favor."
The vet nodded. The soldiers led the Chinese prisoners to the opening in the woods and untied their hands. The corporal drew a large circle on the ground using a baseball bat, though why a soldier would have a bat was a mystery to the vet, and ordered the prisoners in Japanese to dig a deep hole the size of the circle. With the picks and shovels, the four men in baseball uniform started digging in silence. Half the squad stood guard over them while the other half stretched out beneath the trees. They seemed to be in desperate need of sleep. No sooner had they hit the ground in full gear than they began snoring. The four soldiers who remained awake kept watch over the digging nearby, rifles resting on their hips, bayonets fixed, ready for immediate use. The lieutenant and the corporal took turns overseeing the work and napping under the trees. It took less than an hour for the four Chinese prisoners to dig a hole some 12 feet across and deep enough to come up to their necks. One of the men asked for water, speaking in Japanese. The lieutenant nodded, and a soldier brought a bucket full of water. The four Chinese took turns ladling water from the bucket and gulping it down. They drank almost the entire bucketful. Their uniforms were smeared black with blood, mud, and sweat. The lieutenant ordered two of the soldiers to pull the wagon over to the hull. The corporal yanked the tarpaulin off to reveal four dead men piled in the wagon. They wore the same baseball uniforms as the prisoners, and they too were obviously Chinese. They appeared to have been shot, and their uniforms were covered with black bloodstains. Large flies were beginning to swarm over the corpses. Judging from how dry the blood was, the doctor guessed they had been dead for close to 24 hours. The lieutenant ordered the four Chinese who had dug the hole to throw the bodies into it. Without a word, faces blank, the men took the bodies out of the wagon and threw them one at a time into the hole. Each corpse landed with a dull thud. The numbers on the dead men's uniforms were 2, 5, 6, and 8. The vet committed them to memory. When the four Chinese had finished throwing the bodies into the hole, the soldiers tied each man to a nearby tree. The lieutenant held up his wrist and studied his watch with a grim expression. Then he looked up towards a spot in the sky for a while, as if searching for something there. He looked like a station master standing on the platform waiting for a hopelessly overdue train. But in fact, he was looking at nothing at all. He was just allowing a certain amount of time to go by. Once he had accomplished that, he turned to the corporal and gave him curt orders to bayonet three of the four prisoners, numbers 1, 7, and 9. Three soldiers were chosen and took up their positions in front of the three Chinese. The soldiers looked paler than the men they were about to kill. The Chinese looked too tired to hope for anything. The corporal offered each of them a smoke, but they refused. He put his cigarettes back into his shirt pocket. Taking the vet with him, the lieutenant went to stand some distance from the other soldiers. "You'd better watch this," he said. "This is another way to die." The vet nodded. "The lieutenant is not saying this to me," he thought. "He's saying it to himself." In a gentle voice, the lieutenant explained, "Shooting them would be the simplest and most efficient way to kill them. But we have orders not to waste a single bullet, and certainly not to waste bullets killing Chinese. We're supposed to save our ammunition for the Russians. We'll just bayonet them, I suppose, but that's not as easy as it sounds. By the way, doctor, did they teach you how to use a bayonet in the army?" The doctor explains that as a cavalry vet he had not been trained to use a bayonet. "Well, the proper way to kill a man with a bayonet is this. First you thrust it in under the ribs. Here." The lieutenant pointed to his own torso just above the stomach. "Then you drag the point in a big, deep circle inside him to scramble the organs. Then you thrust upward to puncture the heart. You can't just stick it in and expect him to die. We soldiers have this drummed into us. Hand-to-hand combat using bayonets ranks right up there along with night assaults as the pride of the Imperial Army. Mainly because it's a lot cheaper than tanks and planes and cannons. Of course, you can train all you want, but when all's said and done, what you're stabbing is a straw doll, not a live human being. It doesn't bleed or scream or spill its guts on the ground. These soldiers have never actually killed a human being that way. And neither have I." The lieutenant looked at the corporal and gave him a nod. The corporal barked his order to the three soldiers, who snapped to attention. Then they took a half-step back and thrust out their bayonets, each man aiming his blade at his prisoner. One of the prisoners, number 7, growled something in Chinese that sounded like a curse and gave a defiant spit, which never reached the ground but dribbled down the front of his baseball uniform. At the sound of the next order, the three soldiers thrust their bayonets into the Chinese men with tremendous force. Then, as the lieutenant had said, they twisted the blade so as to rip the men's internal organs and thrust the tips upward. The cries of the Chinese men were not very loud, more like deep sobs than screams, as if they were heaving out the breath left in their bodies all at once through a single opening. The soldiers pulled out their bayonets and stepped back. The corporal barked his order again, and the men repeated the procedure exactly as before, stabbing, twisting, thrusting upward, withdrawing. The vet watched in numbed silence, overtaken by the